Mr. O'Rourke.
Good morning, Your Honor. Honorable members of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, good morning. My name is Michael O'Rourke. I represent Judith Rogan, the appellant in the case before Your Honors. And we are here, Your Honor, to urge that the court reverse and vacate the preliminary injunction order that was issued against Mrs. Rogan in September 2008. Basically, Your Honors, we urge the court to find that the preliminary injunction order was improvidently issued because the court clearly lacks subject matter jurisdiction upon which to enter that injunction. That injunction was issued on the basis of a series of citations that were issued in 2007, where the underlying case lacked diversity, proper diversity of citizenship between the parties, and where a non-final judgment existed. There was no final judgment at the time the citations were issued.
Dacia cited this Newman Green case for the proposition that a court may preserve jurisdiction even after a final judgment has been rendered by dismissing non-diverse, dispensable parties. And there was no response to their citation of that case. And I was wondering if you'd like to respond now.
Judge Robner. The actual curative order by Judge Cannelli to purportedly cure that under Rule 21, came in a supplemental proceeding, which we do not believe gave the court jurisdiction to do that. Rule 21 also, Your Honor, by its terms, relates to the action underlying. And the court, this court in March, in its very instructive decision in the Star Insurance versus Risk Marketing case, made it clear that a supplemental proceeding is a separate action completely. If it's true, Your Honor.
What?
Pardon me?
So what?
So
supplemental action is a separate action. That's fine. But the usual consequence of that is that you can't challenge the validity of the underlying judgment. And that means you can't say there was no jurisdiction to enter the underlying judgment. Once the underlying judgment exists, it exists.
Your Honor, correct, but we contend that the underlying judgment was not, in fact, final.
Fine. Okay. If what you're saying is that the underlying judgment is still open to revision, then you have my colleague's question, because Newman Green says any time before final judgment, the district judge can dismiss the spoilers. And actually, in Newman Green, this court dismissed the jurisdictional spoilers on appeal after final judgment, and the Supreme Court said that was proper. So if there was no final judgment, there seems to be no problem whatsoever with using Newman Green. And if there was a final judgment, then I don't see how you can collaterally attack it.
Well, Your Honor, even if you use a Newman Green to retroactively return to the original case and cure that the lack of finality, you have the intervening citation, which was issued, and this is the lesson of the Marble Emporium case versus Fusanovic, which says
Would you deal with Newman Green?
Yes, Your Honor.
Remember, Newman Green is a case in which the spoilers were dismissed on appeal after final judgment in order to validate something that had already happened.
Correct, Your Honor, but Newman Green is a case that stands for the proposition that the actual curative act has to occur before the expiration of appeal. There has been no case that we have found, Judge Easterbrook, which allows a Rule 21 action to occur after the time for the appeal of the underlying judgment has occurred and in a supplemental proceeding.
I'll say you're losing me. You just have said there was no final judgment. there's no final judgment,
right,
there's no problem with correction. If there is a final judgment, if something is no longer subject to review, then your client can't collaterally attack it. So I'm lost how you think you get anywhere by playing this game about there was no final judgment, there was a final judgment. There, you have a problem either way.
Well, Your Honor, Judge Eastberg, we are relying on very clear precedent by this court in focusing on the procedures, the adoption of the procedures of Illinois state law with respect to enforcement of judgments, which clearly states in the Marble Emporium case that whether or not a judgment can be retroactively cured, what you have to do in that event is restart or reinstitute the citation. I will grant you, Your Honor, that there is no clear precedent that says Judge Kennelly cannot go at some point and go back and cure the judgment. However, under state supplemental proceedings law, which is, as the court said in the Star Insurance case, is the procedures to use under Rule 69, clearly the trial court had to have invalidated the present orders, invalidated the injunction, and it required a restart of the process. Otherwise, the message would be, Your Honor, that it doesn't matter if you have a final judgment. Enforce it, and we'll go back and take care of it later.
The argument you're making, counsel, was the argument carried the day for a majority of this court en banc in Newman Green, that is, that you had to vacate and start over, and which the Supreme Court reversed. It doesn't seem to me plausible for this circuit to go back to a position that has already been reversed by the Supreme Court of the United States. That's why we keep asking you to talk about Newman Green.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that Newman Green is an apposite because of the procedural circumstances that are present in this case, and that we do not have a situation where a court, before the expiration of the appeals, can, takes action. We believe that court views on the use and the propriety of state enforcement actions really directs us to tell the plaintiff Dexia that its citation was invalid and that it had to, in fact, reinstitute the citations because the enforcement of the underlying judgment was simply not present.
Maybe we should go on to something else.
Your Honor, we have other points that we've made in our briefs. We do not believe that the actual injunction was properly entered on the basis of competent evidence. There was, in fact, no witnesses called by Dexia. There was, in fact, no real trial evidence that was presented.
Is this your argument that the documents on which the district court relied had no foundation, haven't been authenticated? Is that what you're arguing now?
There was absolutely, we're saying that there was that affidavit was not competent upon which a motion for preliminary injunction could be based, and
but Dexia seems to say that those documents were produced by Judith and Peter Rogan and by third party financial institutions. Is there really any doubt as to the authenticity of or foundation of these documents? And if there is, why didn't Judith challenge them with her own evidence?
Well, we did move in limine to bar the affidavit and bar the documents. The documents were not with proper foundation or with proper evidentiary foundation for a purpose of a preliminary injunction. It was a lawyer's affidavit, which was in effect withdrawn, only supported the TRO, and at the time that the burden of moving forward lay with the movement, Dexia decided not to call any witnesses. We did call witnesses, presented testimony. We, however, during the pendency of the of the trial, was notified that another injunction had in fact been entered up in the Canadian courts, leading us to filing of a bankruptcy for the movement, and which she eventually filed in September of 2008. So, Your Honor, we do not believe that Rule 65 was met. We also believe that Rule 52 was not followed, given its requirements for specificity of findings regarding the findings of fact and conclusions of law, and that the injunction itself was overly broad and not tailored to meet the specific needs.
Well,
and,
it seems to me that under all of these circumstances, the district court entered as specific an injunction as it could. And, you know, it's pretty clear why it was issued. Judith Rogan is doing everything in her power to help her husband hide his assets or their assets from creditors. You know.
Your Honor, Judge Rosen, there was no evidence that there was any activity by Judith Rogan at any time around the entry of the judgment that Dexia obtained of hiding assets. All these facts that were we don't think properly maintained in the affidavit related to activities that occurred years before. There was absolutely no exigent circumstances upon which the TRO should have been entered. It should not have been entered.
I mean, the money isn't all being rushed up to Canada?
Rushed up, Your Honor. There hadn't been any movements in 2 years. So there was no rush up to Canada. There was certainly an effort to help support her husband, but there wasn't a
with millions and millions.
Well, there was no wholesale effort to dissipate assets. There wasn't sales of real estate and things like that, Your Honor.
Glad so. My husband doesn't know about this wife.
Well,
this is a good.
Well, Your Honor, he might, I don't know, but Judge Rover. But again, we just think that the whole proceedings that went before was really in violation of the procedural requirements required under 65, and that we believe that the underlying case still has jurisdictional problems because we've since found out that there's another party involved, LaSalle Bank, which bought a $20 million participation in the underlying letter of credit, and we are challenging the subject matter jurisdiction right now before the court because LaSalle Bank, we believe under the court's holding in Eastland Investments, is also a non-diverse party on the plaintiff's side to one of the defendants. So there's still serious jurisdictional problems present in the underlying case, and we believe ultimately the case should be dismissed. And that's all I have, Your Honors. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mendeloff.
Thank you, Chief Judge Easterbrook. If it pleases the Court, Scott Mendeloff on behalf of Dexia. I'd like to address some of these jurisdictional points that you raised, and specifically the notion that somehow Newman Green doesn't apply here. It's unquestionably the case that this case falls squarely within Newman Green. Granted, the dismissal of the non-diverse party, Newman Green, was on appeal and not on a supplemental proceeding, but even following the notion that a supplemental proceeding is a separate proceeding, there's absolutely nothing wrong with Judge Kennelly's actions here. He had a complete right to dismiss the non-diverse party when he did. There's a mention in the reply brief that somehow because Judge Kennelly ruled while this case was on appeal, that he was divested of the power to be able to enter that ruling, and unquestionably that's not the case. The case law is clear, and we cited cases in our brief that ruling that when an injunction is up on appeal, that does not divest the underlying court with jurisdiction over the merits. So he had the power at any time, as to quote Rule 21.
Is the underlying action final now, and if so, when did the judgment become final?
Your Honor, you raise exactly the point that I wanted to emphasize to the court. It is final, and it became final effectively at the time the the judgment was entered by Judge Phil.
Could you avoid weasel words like effectively? Tell me when it became final.
Well, the reason I say effectively is because of Your Honor, the point Your Honor raised in your dissent in Newman Green, that the effect of a Rule 21 ruling is to retroactively validate everything.
Please answer my question. When did the judgment become final?
The time Judge Phillip entered final judgment.
That's circular. When did the judgment become final?
May 2007. Apologize,
May 2007. Okay. And you can tell me why now.
Okay. And the reason, what I was getting at is, in Your Honor's dissent in Newman Green, Your Honor pointed out.
It makes no difference. Dissents are gone. The applicable opinion here is the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Your Honor, agreed. And my point was going to be that there has not been a ruling by a panel in the Seventh Circuit that we can find that validates Your Honor's remark on your dissent. But there have been rulings in the Second Circuit that uphold that principle, that when a Rule 21 order is entered, it is retroactively effective from the beginning of the decision, beginning of the case. We do not find a Seventh Circuit opinion that has so held to date, and it would be helpful to have one. There are two Second Circuit opinions that have held as along those lines, which we cite.
You know, it seems that, at least in part, the injunction requires Judith Rovin to do certain things with assets that belong to her children or her children's trusts. And, first of all, are the children adults?
Yes, Your Honor.
Were they also brought in on the citation to discover assets?
The trusts were, and we just completed the trial on that issue in front of Judge Cannella yesterday. But
But what I'm trying to understand is how she has the legal ability to do anything with assets that don't seem to be hers.
She doesn't as to assets that don't be, that aren't hers or that just she doesn't have access to. I point out that the form of the injunction should not be before the court. And the reason is that there was no objection made at the time Judge Cannella entered the injunction as to the form of the injunction. Furthermore, thereafter, when Judge Cannella again addressed the form of the injunction, stating his rationale, again there was no objection made. So the interveners, my opponents, have waived any challenge to the form of the injunction.
Well, for instance, I understand that the bankruptcy petition was eventually dismissed, but at the time that the district court entered the injunction, was the automatic stay in place?
That was actually a subject of briefing, and the automatic stay never, number one, the automatic stay was never in place because the ruling of the bankruptcy court was that the case that she had filed was invalid from ab initio. So there was no automatic stay.
So because of that, the subsequent dismissal of the bankruptcy petition cures the problem?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the bankruptcy court's order specifically says that he didn't just dismiss it, but that it was a nullity, that the filing was a nullity. It was as if it never happened. So there could not have been an automatic stay problem.
That dismissal order subject to appeal in Indiana?
It was, and it was not appealed. Furthermore, Your Honor, the ruling by Judge Cannella on February 9th removing the jurisdictional spoilers was not appealed. So we have the unique circumstance here where, of course, the court can test its own jurisdiction, but there should not be an ability to challenge they've waived their ability, it's our view, to challenge the rationale of Judge Cannella's ruling on February 9th because they didn't appeal it.
Does the record tell us why all of these people were indicted, pled guilty, but not the Rogans?
No, Your Honor, the record, that is not part of the record. And that was obviously a decision by the U.S. Attorney's Office. There was, although what is in the record is that there was a subsequent trial, civil trial on a False Claims Act against Mr. Rogan, for which he was found guilty and liable for $64 million.
Well,
as to the...
we know that.
As to the question of sufficiency of the evidence, I just wanted to make one point, which is that by withdrawing their proof, all of their proof, the interveners effectively waived this argument. And the reason is that, as Judge Posner has held both in Thai Inc. and in the Amster copyright litigation.
I've already mentioned this, but you seem determined to keep engaging in ad hominem arguments. It makes no difference who writes opinions for the court. They are decisions of the court.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize. As the court ruled in those two cases, there is no requirement that the district court hold a hearing on an injunction if there is not contrary evidence presenting material and genuine issues of fact. By withdrawing all of their proof, there was no material and genuine issue of fact. And as a result, to quote Amster, they must take the responsibility for this self-inflicted wound. They cannot thus make an argument at this point in time that somehow the proof was inadequate. Furthermore, as Judge Rovner indicates, the proof that they're challenging is in effect self-authenticating. So the authentication issue is really a non-issue. And finally, as we point out in our brief, citing Levi Strauss for a proposition that the Seventh Circuit has upheld many times, in an injunction hearing, hearsay evidence is fully admissible, and as a result, the nature of the proof should be of no merit. If you have any other further questions, I'll be happy to address them.
What's happening in Canada?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
What is happening in Canada?
Right after we obtain an injunction against freezing Mr. and Mrs. Rogan's assets in the United States, we obtained a Mareva order in Canada doing the same thing there. Mr. Rogan had, as the record reveals, absconded to Canada right after the ruling by Judge Dara and was there with, according to the record, at least $3 million worth of assets. Accordingly, we wanted to make sure that those assets didn't disappear and got Canadian counsel to obtain a Mareva injunction there.
And has that been appealed?
That's currently under what is an extensive discovery process there, but also because of Mrs. Rogan's filing of her bankruptcy case here, they're honoring the automatic stay as to her part of that case, even though they don't have to, they are. So the only issue in that case right now is Mr. Rogan's assets. We're still waiting for the bankruptcy court to rule on our motion to allow Judge Connelly to proceed effectively liquidate our claims against Mrs. Rogan and determine whether or not the assets are even hers. If they're not, then they're obviously not subject to the resolution for a state in bankruptcy.
So that's the Indiana bankruptcy?
That's the Indiana bankruptcy, correct. And that has an implication for the Canadian case because the Canadian courts are waiting for the Indiana court to rule.
Very complicated. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. O'Rourke?
A few points, Your Honor. Thank you. To clarify for Judge Rovner, the Indiana bankruptcy, which was filed on September 24th, was dismissed strictly on a technical ground because the schedules had not been fully filed. They were, in fact, filed that weekend. And it was a clerk's dismissal. It wasn't anything that Judge Klingenberger did on the merits. and she is now in bankruptcy. We do not agree that there is any waiver regarding the burden of proof and the responsibility to bring forward evidence. We had filed affidavits which contested the material allegations of the preliminary injunction. We actually went to hearing because the court recognized that that we joined the issues, and when the court proceeded with the preliminary injunction, was at that point that Dexia essentially just left the field and did not put on any competent evidence, but rested, in fact, on an affidavit which we had strenuously objected to as being inadequate, certainly for preliminary injunction purposes.
But they were your documents, were they not?
No, Your Honor, they were not. They were not our documents. They were documents of companies and individuals and entities numbering in the many, many dozens that were not, none of which had to do, 99% had nothing to do with Judith Rogan whatsoever. We were not. She was not part of the businesses. She was not part of the hospital operations. She had her standalone assets, and they were all frozen on the basis of a lawyer's affidavit with documents which were certainly foreign to us and were not certainly simply in no way admissions at all by us as to the propriety of the allegations that were based on those documents, which were never properly presented in evidence in the court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.